Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's foreign policy team and his worldview outlined to the editorial board of the Washington Post, as well as his speech to the APEC conference tonight in Washington, and speak with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the founding president of the Truman National Security Project, who served as a security expert on the Foreign Affairs Policy Board at the United States Department of State. Then we'll get an update on President Obama's historic visit to Cuba, where today in Havana, Obama said he believes that change is going to happen here, and I think that Raul Castro understands that. A former political analyst with the Cuban government, who is now a lecturer at the University of Texas, Arturo Lopez Levy, joins us to discuss where Raul Castro's and Barack Obama's views converge in private, since they appear to diverge in public, with Raul Castro speaking at a joint news conference with Obama, denying that there are any political prisoners in Cuba, challenging the journalists to, quote, give him a list and they would be released tonight. And then finally, we'll examine the possibility that a growing national protest movement against Donald Trump will dog him all the way to November and create optics that may prove unsettling to most voters, as Donald Trump could come to be seen as the candidate of chaos. Marilyn Katz, a writer, consultant and longtime political activist who is a partner with Democracy Partners and a founder and co-chair of Chicago Women Take Action, joins us to discuss whether student protests will hurt Trump or help him, and her article at In These Times, Stopping Trump, the Chicago Model. And joining us now is Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project. In 2011, Secretary Clinton appointed Rachel to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the U.S. Department of State. Her latest book is Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld.
Wonderful to be here, Ian.
And I guess I don't know really where to begin. Donald Trump has a busy day. He met with the editorial board of the Washington Post, where he announced some of his foreign policy advisors, and then he, of course, spoke to APEC tonight. So let's start with the fairly sort of isolationist statements that he made to the editorial board of the Washington Post, and then we get on to talking about some of the advisors. I guess it's hard to pin him down. I mean, without appearing to be too critical and partisan, he seems to be all over the place.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I like outsiders. I'm from Alaska myself. I think that D.C. could use some shaking up. But outsider does not mean off the cuff. You can't have a foreign policy that's run on the seat of your pants. It's too important. There's a man with his button on our nuclear weapons. And to have Trump be that man is, frankly, pretty scary.
And what was your sense then of the team that he's that he announced? Not that it, I mean, I assume that there are more people on his team, but at least he announced five people of this team that's chaired by Senator Jeff Sessions.
Well, you know, I've heard them called a B list. I would say they're more of a C list. I mean, there were some names there that I had to look up myself. He's got an expert on the Middle East who's a Maronite Christian who was involved himself. He's Lebanese, and he was involved himself in armed action in Lebanon. Is he going to pull us into activities in the Middle East that we don't want to be involved in? That would be worrisome. He has no one on China. China, I would consider a fairly big and important issue. It's got the world's biggest army. It's building aircraft carriers. It's stealing a lot of our business and our data. I'd like to know that he had someone looking into that. He has no one on Mexico and Latin America. So here he is saying he wants to build a wall, and they're saying they don't want to pay for it. It would help to have someone who knows something about Mexico and Latin America. He does have a guy on Russia, but the person he named on Russia, Carter Page, has spent 3 years making deals with Gazprom, which is Moscow's oil and energy arm. You know, you don't spend 3 years making deals with them and come away with completely clean hands. You gotta negotiate. And so that's worrisome if that's your guy on Russia. I could go on and on. You know, the people he's chosen are really, George Papadopoulos is based in London. He's not based in America. He spent a couple of years doing some marginal work on oil and gas, and then he went to become a consultant to oil and gas companies. And this is not who you really want controlling the foreign policy of the best country and the biggest country in the world on these issues.
Well, the general that he named, Keith Kellogg, worked with Arthur Bremer, the provisional coalition provisional authority. He worked under him implementing Bremer's plans. So that was most analysts say that was the sort of the heart of the disaster that became Iraq.
Yeah, and you know it's not clear how to decide that. You know, the Lieutenant General Kellogg did run the 82nd Airborne Division, and that's an important division. And I give him credit for running it. That's an important job. On the other hand, as you said, he worked as COO right under Paul Bremer during 4 months, and it was only 4 months, but they were pretty crucial 4 months right at the beginning of the Iraq occupation when a lot went wrong. That was really when a lot of the decisions were taken. And then you kind of have to wonder, why was he only there for 4 months? And then his final assignment was working for the Joint Chiefs of Staff as director of the Command, Control, Communications, and Computers Division. That was really before there was much cybersecurity. So he got put in charge of computers, and it's not clear to me that that was a promotion.
And Waleed Faris, who you mentioned, he was actually he was fighting with the Falangist, I believe, the Christian militia, which is the pretty neo-fascist operation, isn't it?
It's real murky what he was doing. Some people say he was an ideologue for the Falangists. Some people say he was fighting. Some people say he was controlling some of their analytic division. And I don't know. I wasn't there with him. But I do know that the Christians play a major political role in Lebanon. Lebanon was involved in a civil war at the time, and Lebanon is still very shaky territory, more shaky now because of so many Syrian refugees. And I, for one, don't want to get America pulled into the Lebanese war issues unless we choose to be. I don't want an advisor with skin in the game there. And he certainly has skin in the game, whatever his role exactly was.
Well, just to finish up, General Joseph Schmitz resigned from the military in 2005 amid accusations of misconduct. Any more light to be shed on the final choice, or at least the ones that were announced today by Donald Trump?
Sure. I mean, I think you put your finger on it. He was under investigation for spending taxpayer money on some pet projects. He was very obsessed with his bathroom, people say, when they talk about his time there and redecorating his bathroom. And there seem to have been more important things in my mind that the Pentagon IG could have been doing in the early 2000s when we were in two wars at that point. People think he was smart, but he just, you know, smart. There's a lot of smart people in the world. You need somebody who's a real leader, and he does not seem to have been that.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, who's a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment International Peace. And she was on the advisory board to the U.S. Department of State. And her latest book is Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. Let's turn then to the speech that Donald Trump made to AIPAC, which was much anticipated. I mean, the extraordinarily casual way that he attacks people, dismisses them, you know, he's a loser, she's a failure, you know, all this kind of off-the-cuff, poisonous, dismissive language. He applied some of that, actually, to Hillary Clinton. Of course, after trashing John Kerry and others to the editorial board of the Washington Post, he mentioned that in his speech to AIPAC that Hillary Clinton was tired. So you work for her. She's got a pretty punishing schedule running for the president of the United States. But she seems to get up there on the podium, and she's pretty alert, pretty tough. And I would say that's one hell of a crucible that she's putting herself through.
I would say the same. You know, whether you like Hillary Clinton or not, and I certainly know people on both sides of that equation, and I should say that I was appointed to work at the State Department on the board, but you know, she doesn't have any personal ties to me, and I don't owe her anything myself. But boy, you cannot dispute that she works really hard and that she travels and gets the job done and is indefatigable. She would make me tired, and she has about 20 years on me. And I would not, if you're looking to criticize Hillary Clinton, calling her tired is not the way to do it. You know, I think the bigger problem with the AIPAC speech is that no one called him out on the fact that he's been endorsed by David Duke. Now, he could kind of shamble around that and pretend that he didn't know who David Duke was and that sort of thing, but I think as a Jew in America, that's worrisome if that's the kind of friendships you're keeping. He's got campaign staffers who seem to have ties to neo-Nazi parties. This is not a friend to the Jewish people.
Well, he in a curiously kind of somewhat cliched, if not anti-Semitic way, he more or less referred to the audience as a bunch of fellow deal makers and talked about how the kind of deals he made and urged them to read his book, The Art of the Deal. And that was met by a considerable amount of mocking laughter.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the biggest problem with having someone like Trump at the helm is that a lot of people are angry, and they're angry at the establishment, and they're angry at the way things have been going. And frankly, I'm not particularly happy myself with where our country is right now. But you don't want someone who you don't know where they stand on foreign policy issues. And what Trump tends to do is say whatever he thinks at that minute, and it might contradict something he said 2 minutes before or 5 minutes before, and he doesn't think through the next step and the next step. Well, when you're doing foreign policy, especially on issues as delicate as Israel, you'd better be thinking a couple steps ahead. And I don't think he has that capacity.
Well, frankly, I've made the observation some time back that he struck me as being, if he were to become president of the United States, this would be a historic change in American governance, that we would essentially have a more of a kind of third world type leader or a strongman like Putin or Erdogan in Turkey. Some people have said, of course, he's closer to the libertine Italian, Berlusconi. But there was a very kind of, I thought, a very effective op-ed in today's New York Times by somebody who served in the George W. Bush administration, more or less making that same observation that this would be extraordinary, that America would elect a strong man. Do you see him in that mold?
Yeah, I do. And I think you could see him like Chavez. I mean, obviously his politics are different than Chavez, but he's a populist leader like a lot of Latin American populist leaders who ran their countries into the ground. He's got gestures and political speech that sounds a little bit like Mussolini, and he's got a sort of typical demagogue profile. Populism is really attractive. People want to be promised things that they can't have delivered, and you can want that, but there's a lot of things we want in this world that can't come to fruition. But when you look at the populist leaders that have been elected throughout Latin America, boy, did they destroy their countries. And I think Chavez is probably our closest recent example.
But in some of the stuff that Trump is saying to the Washington Post, though, really, I think, resonates with a lot of Americans. And frankly, we've had decades now with interest rates, you know, almost at zero, which would have been an incredibly propitious time to invest in our crumbling infrastructure. But, of course, because of the obdurate blockage in the Republican-controlled Congress, nothing gets done. But, nevertheless, he's making that case, which is a case which should have been made, I think, as I say, over the last decade, that, you know, particularly after the 2008 crash, let's put a lot of people to work and build our infrastructure and borrow money incredibly cheaply. He's now more or less, first of all, Trump says that we essentially finance China's extraordinary investment in infrastructure, which I frankly can't figure that one out. But he does talk about, you know, we need to build, you know, forget about nation building abroad. Let's do some at home and let's build our crumbling infrastructure, rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. And I think that is going to resonate.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think the reason that so many people are voting for Trump is that he's saying things people would like to hear their candidates saying. We do need new infrastructure. It's embarrassing to travel around some of the older infrastructure of this country, walking through airports that are dripping and trains that don't run, and think, really, this is the United States of America? So he's going to resonate. He's going to resonate when he says that he can build great things here, that he can build businesses here at home. It's easy to make promises. It's harder to keep them. And I think it's the keeping of them that we really need to be paying some attention to. You know, he says he's going to build American jobs here at home and that he's putting up all these barriers to trade. Well, America is a country of about 300 million people, and there's about 7 billion people in the world. There's a lot of people who are not in America that we need to sell things to. That's how you companies make jobs. And if you ignore that part of the equation, real hard to create jobs here at home. But, you know, he wants to have it both ways. And as long as people are willing to say that's what we want to hear a candidate say and not say, well, how's he going to deliver? We're going to keep getting people voting for him.
But this stump speech that he has attacking China and how we've got poor negotiators here and how much clever the Chinese are than we are. I mean, do you think that resonates? I mean, I know that he started out trashing the Mexicans, and then he moved to trashing women, and then he shut the door on a huge religion of 1.6 billion people and said they couldn't come into the United States, etc. But what is this obsession with China, and do you think that in any way resonates? I mean, frankly, everything you pick up says made in China. It's not as if we're not all somehow complicit in buying Chinese goods.
Yeah. Well, clearly it resonates because people are voting, and that's about as clear a signal you can give that somebody is resonating with you. I think, you know, it's worrisome that he's making all these statements about China and didn't even list a China person in his top foreign policy experts. So it's not clear what he's basing his understanding on. China is a real tough problem, and it's a bad problem. I have been there. I've been in conferences with the top leadership of China. They are tough negotiators. They are not on our side. They are not our friends. I don't think they're our enemies. We really don't want a third world war with China. But they're certainly not our friends, and that means it's a real tough negotiating job. It's like your bureaucratic office mate who'd like your job, but you have to be friendly with. Tough relationship. And I don't trust Trump to get that relationship right, and I think if we don't get it right, that's a lot of jobs in America that could go overseas because he's getting it wrong.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Rachel, what's your sense then of the potential that Trump has to, in many ways, assuming he gets past the Republican establishment, who are desperately trying to stop him, and gets the nomination, of course, the Republican senators and congresspeople are terrified that there's going to be a tremendous down-ballot damage to them. Nevertheless, if he gets to run for president in the fall, he could run to the left of Hillary Clinton on a lot of foreign policy issues and on this infrastructure issue that we've been talking about. How does she deal with that?
Well, I think it's time to take Trump very seriously. I think for too long everyone has been pretending that he would shoot himself in the foot or drop out or that no one like him could win. But the fact is, people like him have won in many other countries, and it destroys the country, but they still get the votes. And we need to take that real seriously. You're absolutely right that he is all over the place politically. He doesn't fit into the normal ideological categories. It's a typical populist platform. It's a bread and circuses platform, and it's about giving people exactly what they want and paying no attention to how you're going to deliver. So I think it's time for reporters, for everyday people at his rallies and so on, to ask the how. How is he going to do that? And not to take the answer, well, because I'm great. You know, you don't hire someone who just tells you they're great. You look at their references and you try to figure out what they can do in this sphere. And in the foreign policy sphere, he does not have much by way of references. And he's already said that he's his top foreign policy person. So I think we'd better take a good long look and we'd better start asking how is he going to deliver.
Well, Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, who's a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project, and in 2011, Secretary Clinton appointed Rachel to the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the U.S. Department of State. Her latest book is Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about President Obama's historical trip to Cuba with a former member of the Cuban government.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Yes, war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Arturo López-Levy, who's a lecturer at the University of Texas and an expert on Latin American politics, American politics, and U.S. foreign policy in Cuba. Before his emigration to the United States, he worked as a political analyst for the Cuban government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arturo López-Levy.
What a great pleasure to be again with you, Ian, in your programs.
Well, thank you, Arturo. And apparently, according to Barack Obama, standing with Cuban President Raúl Castro in Havana today, Obama said, "This is a new day. Es un nuevo día between our two countries." So do you see it as a new day?
I think so. I think that you know, we should not oversell the achievements of this visit, but you know, after so much conflict and after so much acrimony between the two nations, today is a day of great celebration. For the first time, let me tell you, people talk about a visit of an American president to Cuba. This is a historical watermark, because the United States has acted with the dignity and the clarity of a democratic great power and has gone to Cuba. The president has gone to Cuba. He has spoken about respect. He has spoken about promoting a progressive change in Cuba, but empowering Cuban actors, not by imposing anything from outside. And this is something that has no precedent in the relationship between the White House and Cuba. President James Carter and President Clinton spoke about the need to have this kind of relationship, but they did it in their memoirs. They did some things in this direction, but while they were in office, they were unable to take the ball so far. What President Obama has done is, in office, he has gone to Cuba, and let me tell you, I just came back from Cuba yesterday, and there was a lot of sympathy for the first African-American president, and many people saw him as a champion of the cause of good relationship between the two nations.
Well, after the meeting today, there was no press conference planned, but a last-minute change made it possible, and President Obama first called on CNN's Jim Acosta, who apparently is a Cuban-American. He spoke in Spanish and asked President Raúl Castro why his country kept political prisoners, and Castro was clearly annoyed, and he denied that Cuba has political prisoners, and challenged the reporter, "Give me a list after this press conference. If there are political prisoners, they will be released by nightfall. That's it." So that's not to say that they may converge in private, but obviously in public there was a divergence apparent there.
Well, I think that this is part of the dialogue and interaction that happen when you have a policy of engagement. And obviously, there are differences of values between the two systems and the two governments, but this is something that put those differences in a controllable range. And here, it is simple. It's clear that for Cuba, certain people are not political prisoners, but for America, they are. There are some international standards, what we call, what Amnesty International call prisoners of conscience. And I heard that the list is close to 40. The proof will be in the pudding. If those people are in prisons for expressing political ideas, because even if you disagree with the nature of the Cuban government, if you engage in activities, let's say, to try to hijack a boat to come to the United States, that's not a political action, or let's say you plan to attack a military barracks, this is not an act of conscience, even if you disagree with the government against which those actions are taken. But there is an area there that I think there might be some positive outcome. There might be some areas that both Cuba and the United States, and particularly the international community, will say, wait a second, if this person was arrested and sent to prison, let's say for some years, just because they were expressing some point of view, the Cuban government need to release them. It is the word of their own president.
Well, of course, there have been these longstanding demonstrations of the ladies in white, which the Cuban government has often said, is, you know, the U.S. government funds them, and it's sort of a CIA operation, and some of them were arrested today, I believe. But with having the President of the United States in Havana at the same time, it does undercut that argument, surely, that the U.S. is destabilizing Cuba when you got the U.S. president there standing next to Raul Castro.
Well, let me put some things there in more precise terms. The ladies in white is not the Cuban government. They openly said that they receive money from the U.S. government and they will keep doing so. That was a source of a major division within the ladies in white, because some of the ladies in white, such as Miriam Leyva, for instance, they claim that they don't want to receive any money from the U.S. government as long as the U.S. was applying a policy that they consider a violation of human rights, such as the embargo blockade. That is the way they express that in Cuba. But the group that prevailed within the Ladies in White, led by a lady by the name of Berta Soler, they say very openly that they will receive money from whoever give it to them, including people in Miami that has been involved in terrorist activities against Cuba. In my view, this was a terrible decision by the leader of the Ladies in White, Berta Soler, that allowed the Cuban government to frame them as kind of U.S. tools of regime change and connected to people whose actions are considered illegitimate by not only by the Cuban government, but by the whole international community. Somebody who put a bomb in a plane like Luis Posada Carriles is considered everywhere a terrorist, except that at some point President Bush, the father, gave a pardon to his accomplice in this action, Orlando Bosch Avila, and even the mayor of Miami at that time put his name to a street. But all that said, it is clear that the human rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, recognize the freedom of assembly and the freedom of expression. And the policy of catch and release, short detention that the Cuban government is applying, is a deviation of those standards. And although we cannot judge the situation of human rights in general in Cuba by the numbers of short detention, many of these people are arrested at noon and released at 6 o'clock, It's obviously a deviation of human rights standard when people are not allowed to obtain a permission and make a demonstration against the Cuban government. And I think that in order to be objective, we need to say there are deviations of human rights standard, but in general, the human rights situation in Cuba had improved as a result of the process of economic reform, political liberalization led by Raúl Castro, and also, in some sense, influenced by the more friendly the friendlier environment created by the policy of President Obama.
And again, I'm speaking with Arturo López-Levy, who's a lecturer at the University of Texas and an expert on Latin American politics, American politics, and U.S. foreign policy in Cuba. Before his emigration to the United States, he worked as a political analyst for the Cuban government. And in terms of this human rights argument, there is, of course, what President Castro said was, we defend human rights. In our view, civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights are indivisible, interdependent, and universal. Actually, we find it inconceivable that a government does not defend and ensure the right to health care, education, social security, food provision, and development. And, of course, that is something that I think is worth hearing here in the United States. I mean, we do, after all, have people in the streets, homeless people in growing numbers. We have the world's largest prison population, and it's a little difficult to lecture on human rights when our own house is not in order. So do you think that we're going to move beyond this polarized discussion between these two countries?
I think, you know, let's put the difference in human rights in context. The two countries have important difference of values. The system, the political system in Cuba and the political system in the United States, they are based on different values. Both systems has some deviation from the international human rights standard. Some of them are more are bigger than the other. I think that Raúl Castro, when he used the achievements in social, cultural, and economic rights to, in some sense, cover the issue of civil and political rights, it is in a position that is not coherent with his own logic that the human rights are interdependent, universal, indivisible. And I think that it is something that the United States has to take into account. Whenever there is a dialogue about human rights between Cuba and the United States, Cuba should be ready to accept the idea that it is the right of every nation in the world, even if they if those nations don't have a perfect record, to denounce, name, and shame violations of human rights in Cuba. At the same time, the United States should not approach this dialogue with a sense of superiority. The United States has its own issues of human rights, and it is part of the dignity of a democratic country to take those things straight and basically contrast them with the international human rights standards. And it is clear that in many areas, not only the United States has not subscribed some of the international instruments, but it has its own deviations. And you just mentioned a couple of them.
Well, President Obama, of course, said in Havana that change is going to happen here, and I think that Raúl Castro understands that. He also apparently mentioned to ABC that he would be announcing that Google has made a deal with the Cuban authorities to help Cuba expand and update, or, you know, it's actually pretty poor condition, the Wi-Fi and broadband access. As you know, Internet, I think, one of the lowest penetrations of Internet in the world in Cuba. So what's your understanding then in terms of what deals are going on between these two men and what we're likely to see coming out of this historic visit?
I think that both presidents had understood that they could be partners in moving the relationship between the two countries from a very bad situation to one that it's more convenient for both government and both nations. So I think they are working on that. In some sense, they have worked as partners against potential spoilers. There was a lot of debate in Cuba, and hardliners such as blogger and ideologue Uriel Sanchez, if you read Spanish, you can read his blog called La Pupila Insomne, or The Sleepless Eye. And in this blog, he was very adamant and alarmed against the potential damage to the Cuban political system of unrestricted access to internet and different website media expressing opinions about the Cuban government. And Raúl Castro basically say, you know what, we should not operate in such a narrow view. And he basically makes some deals with some American companies. That doesn't mean that Cuba is adopting international liberal standards, but it is a big improvement. And, you know, it is very important to look at the U.S.-Cuba relations as a movie and not as a frozen picture, because we are in a dynamic that might become a virtuous cycle. Cuba is able to improve its standards in areas that need to be improved, and the United States also changed a policy that has been tremendously harmful for Americans' interests and values. And when I mean American interests and values, I think in the same way that Martin Luther King thought, that the real Americans are the ones that take the Declaration of Independence as a check to cash, in which everybody has the right to some equality and the respect of the dignity of other nations and other countries. It's an important part of the American tradition, although at times some of our authorities have deviated from that.
So what's your sense then, just in closing, Arturo López Levy? I mean, I understand that you know Raúl Castro, or you've worked with him.
In the past.
It's interesting that the president is not meeting with Fidel Castro, of course, but he is meeting clearly with Raúl Castro. What kind of a man is he? I mean, obviously there's a difference. Go ahead.
Well, you know, Ian, I was a junior officer in the Cuban Ministry of Interior when I was working for the government. I'm talking about more than 20 years ago. And I have met Raúl Castro in like three occasions. So this is not, I'm not someone that could talk about him as a friend. He's much older than me and all this. But I have the feeling, for what I have seen about contacts that I have with people that know him, is that he is a man very committed to the governance and to keep the one-party system. And in order to do that, he is very pragmatic, he is flexible, but his limits are there. So what can we expect? Someone that will be less ideological, he will try to institutionalize the rule of the Communist Party as a one-party system, something that I personally, it's not optimal for me. But in comparison to previous era, I think that he will take advantage of the opportunity opened by President Obama change of policy. Now Cuba is facing a friendlier international environment for reform and political liberalization. And areas such as freedom to travel, freedom of religion, freedom to own private property, access to information, those are not negligible elements. And I expect that in some of these areas we are going to see some movement. And last but not least, this overtured by President Obama is not addressed only to Raul Castro. In 2018, Raul Castro is retiring, and a new generation of Cuban leaders who are now in their 50s might become the leaders of the country, and they might find that it is possible to have some kind of understanding with the United States, that together with the difference of values, there are common interests that the two countries can explore together.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Arturo López-Levy.
It's a great pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Arturo López-Levy, who's a lecturer at the University of Texas and an expert on Latin American politics, American politics, and U.S. foreign policy in Cuba. Before his emigration to the United States, he worked as a political analyst for the Cuban government. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether protesters can make Donald Trump the candidate of chaos. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Marilyn Katz, a writer, consultant, and longtime political activist. She is president of MK Communications, a partner in Democracy Partners, and a founder and co-chair of the newly formed Chicago Women Take Action. Her latest article in These Times is Stopping Trump, the Chicago Model. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marilyn Katz.
Thank you. It's been a long time since I've been on KPFK.
Well, it's good to have you back. And I was very interested in your piece about how the Chicago demonstrations at the University of Illinois Chicago, where Donald Trump was about to hold a rally, and protesters were both inside and outside, and the rally was shut down. And I think it was one of the first times, perhaps, that the viewing audiences got a taste of bare-knuckle politics in this country in terms of a political rally. But you've gotten into explaining in your article about who these protesters were and, more importantly, how they organized. Because my sense, Marilyn, is that these protesters are here to stay, that they're going to dog Donald Trump all the way to the November elections, assuming he becomes the candidate. And I'm not even sure that it's the optics are going to end up making Donald Trump the candidate of chaos. But let's get to the beginning, because it's in many ways what happened in Chicago was the beginning of this something that seems to be spontaneously happening and growing in this country amongst the young and students, et cetera.
Well, I think I'm very proud of Chicagoans, and I do think it's a model for the country. I got a lot of pushback on the article, and in fact, I've just published a rejoinder to everyone from Charles Krauthammer on the right to David Moberg on the left, who said, and Ron Grossman in the Tribune in the middle, saying demonstrations should stop and that's what buoys Trump and eggs him on. Quite the contrary. I was very proud of Chicagoans. They self-organized, and they did a variety of very smart things. They first... Chicago's a very diverse city, and the University of Illinois, it's a very diverse place with students from all over the world and also reflective of Chicago's polyglot population, Muslims and blacks and whites and women and Indians. And we are a small representation of the world at writ large. And people on their own, not an organized left thing, but the Muslim students and the immigration activists and women, and everyone who had been slandered and mischaracterized by Trump said, why should he speak on our campus? You know, this is, we have something to say. One, we're going to stand up for ourselves and say who we are. We are not his caricatures. And two, together we're going to say that whites and blacks and Asians and brown people actually are unified, and we can actually stand up for ourselves and show total solidarity, which they did. And I think there's a myth going around. Let's be very clear. The threat of violence did not make Trump back down. Quite the contrary. He has egged on violence, particularly when the odds were 10,000 screaming white men and 3 or 4 African-Americans or Latinos. What made him back down is that he was cowered by the prospect of, instead of having the media cover an adulating crowd who cheered at his every threat, his every misogynist insult, his every racist insult, he would have to speak to a group of people, probably a few, couple thousand, of whom were students, whether they be black, Latino, Asian, or white, who were going to call him on his BS. And it was that, not having a totally controlled environment, that made him cancel the rally. He did not want the TV cameras to have him say something, and instead of cheers, run into boos, or, you know, Black Lives Matter, or Women Matter, or if Muslims matter, about anybody matters. He much prefers what happened today at AIPAC, which is, unbelievably, Trump was greeted with great applause, and that's really scary. Kind of reminds you of certain Jews in Germany who cheered Hitler and thought he'd bring order to the country.
Well, what was the ratio then of do you think, in Chicago, of Trump supporters to protesters in the hall?
I would imagine they were the majority. I think probably 2,000 or 3,000 of us got tickets, but the pavilion holds around 10,000, so the vast majority would be Trump supporters. Mm. You know, it's been described as violent. That's the farthest thing from the truth. In all, out of all the thousands of demonstrators outside and a couple thousand inside, there were only 3 arrests. There are bigger scuffles in front of any bar in Chicago on a Saturday night.
Well, we've seen prior to the Chicago, and certainly since, the number of, and you rightly characterize it, there are 10,000 largely white men and 2 or 3 minorities who get, you know, cold-cocked and kicked and thrown out. And that seems to continue, and even now it's starting to sort of implicate Corey Lewandowski, Donald Trump's campaign manager.
Campaign manager.
So, but
here's what I think. I think when bullies are empowered, when people get afraid, that just empowers them. I mean, anyone who went to school knows that, right? That when people cower, that just encourages bullies to do more of their thing. But when people fight back, it's the bullies who cower and who run away. And I'm, you know, I think that we've set a pattern, and hopefully, whether it's people blocking the roads. Listen, you cannot do hate speech. I mean, what if no one had stood up against the Klan, which they didn't for many, many years? We know where that ends up, in lynchings and deaths. So the fact that people stand up and really challenge the things he says, things that threaten to divide us and create the kind of violence that we've seen in the last few years.
And again, I'm speaking with Marilyn Katz, who's a writer, consultant, and longtime political activist. She's president of MK Communications, a partner in Democracy Partners, and a founder and co-chair of the newly formed Chicago Women Take Action. And her latest article in these times is Stopping Trump, the Chicago Model. And actually, her latest article is Chicago Activists Should Be Commended, Not Scolded, for Shutting Down Donald Trump's Rally. So let's talk about the argument that you felt you had to address, being criticized by people on the left and the right and in the center. Do you think these demonstrations help Trump or hurt Trump?
I think a few things. I mean, I think Trump will be most likely the nominee. If anyone's going to stop him, it's going to be the Republican Party, which if it tries to switch him out, will be faced with great rebellion. But I think Trump appeals to and has organized that percentage of the population that's existed for a long time. Just beneath the surface, you know, I don't know if you saw The Big Short, but at the end of the movie, the filmmaker poses, you know, a fairy tale that yes, a Democrat was elected, and they prosecuted the big banks, and they reformed the Wall Street, and everything was fine. But he says, oh, no, that was just a joke. What really happened was nothing changed. People became fearful, and rather than blame the banks, they blamed the Latin and black people and Latinos, et cetera, for taking their jobs, which is really a pretty prophetic notion of what is going on now. Look, people are really scared. And the thing that people have done in this country whenever they get scared by depressions, I mean economic depressions, by change, is they've tended to turn not on those people who make their lives miserable, you know, the captains of industry, but on the people who have the least amount of power, of women, Latinos, blacks. We've seen it, you know, time and again from the founding of this country. So that's not surprising. I think that Trump, I think what we're seeing and we've seen is, and really scary, is the normalization of Trump. That, you know, where he was totally unacceptable to people 3 months ago, 6 months ago, and people were shocked by what he's saying, now you see the Republicans coming around saying, well, I guess I could live with him. And now, oh my God, today you saw AIPAC saying they could live with him. Now this is a guy, I mean, the best part of Jewish tradition is that they have always been or fought for the underdog. Knowing what exclusion and hate speech has led to in their own lives, they've always, the best have always fought, you know, for unions, for women in the civil rights movement. So to see the nation's largest Jewish organization embracing Trump is really scary. Very scary, and it's very important, I believe, that people who are Jewish, who are white, who are whatever we are, stand up and say, this is not okay. This is not okay. Our well-being does not depend on the exclusion or denigration or slander of the other.
Well, as you know, Marilyn Katz, most of the media coverage of elections is all about process. In fact, most coverage
about
of
horse race, right?
Yeah, about politics. In fact, is all about process: who's up, who's down, who had what for breakfast, but not really much analysis of the broader issues involved and the underlying policies, etc. So, as this election season continues, it would seem to me that Trump is likely to be more and more accepted and legitimized. The only people in the press, as far as I know, that have a disclaimer when covering him are the Huffington Post. At the end of their stories on Trump, they say that he's a racist misogynist who wants to exclude 1.6 billion Muslims from America, something along those lines. Do you think that that's a model to follow, that the mainstream media should be called out, not to just to go along with accepting him as a legitimate candidate? You know, should they do what the Huffington Post has done?
Which is I think in one of the reasons you and I have jobs is actually to be truth tellers and to go to the substance of issues, not the horse race. But I think it's unlikely. I do think the media has a responsibility when, you know, one of the social media is wonderful. The flowering of 1,000 channels is really great, but one of the consequences of the fragmentation of the media is that we no longer have four guys, you know, whether it was Edward R. Murrow or Ted Koppel saying, here's a table, here's a purple table, and you could say you liked it, and I could say I dislike it. In the new media reality, you say, this is a purple table, and Glenn Beck says, that's not a table, it's an umbrella. Not only do we not are able to agree on whether we like something or not, we don't agree on what reality is. So I do think it's the role of the media, and they have fallen down on this, so that when Trump says, you know, Mexicans are rapists, and they're flooding the border with rapists, it is the responsibility of the media, in my mind, to say, he says this, but this is not true. Of the 14 million immigrants, legal or documented or not, there's been one rapist. You know, you've got to try to establish a baseline of reality. You know, and then if Glenn Beck says, I don't like Mexicans anyway, that's fine. But at least the media has played the role of saying, what is reality today? Which, by the way, is one of the reasons I wrote the second article. You know, because the my critics bring up 1968, and they bring up the Weimar Republic. And frankly, in 1968, of which I was a part, I was an organizer of the demonstrations at the Chicago Convention. It was not the demonstrations that sunk Humphrey. It was the inability and the unwillingness of the Democratic Party to embrace the demands of the anti-war base, the blacks, of women, who were, in fact, its backbone. And the reality was that even with George Wallace in the race, the race was lost only by 500,000 out of 72 million votes. So we're not talking about any kind of big switch. In fact, the numbers were just about what they were in 1960. So that's a lie. I mean, that's a distortion, and it's been a myth that's been allowed to live for 50 years, and I thought it was time to put it to rest.
Well, just,
it's hard to know the future or how to act if you don't know your history.
Sure. But just in the last minute then, Marilyn Katz, do you think that given what started in Chicago that you've written about and described, and then you had the protesters down in Arizona blocking the highway, and then you've had, and also in Salt Lake City, some very creative protesting, and that seems to me that this is all going to sort of snowball and continue. Is that, do you believe that, and that there's
I
a possibility?
I also believe that this is not an accident. I think that Occupy was better than we thought, and it spawned the movement for a living wage, which in turn has emboldened people to that they can win. These are popular issues, and that I think we are a majority eventually, and that people, as long as they're maligned and that they can fight back and stand up for themselves, will continue, and they should. We should not let truth be trampled by a big bully with a lot of money and a megaphone because of the synergy between media shows as entertainment and Donald Trump as entertainment. He's really not that entertaining. He's just mainly scary.
So at the end of the day, do you think he could become the candidate of chaos?
In
other words, that people watching are going to be unsettled by it in a cumulative sense?
I hope that he becomes a candidate of chaos and therefore totally unacceptable, and that people who are progressives and who tell the truth and who stand with each other, you know, hopefully peacefully, but there will probably be some person who, if they get punched in the nose, is going to punch back, say that we are not going to be trampled by chaos or the candidate of that chaos.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Marilyn Katz.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Marilyn Katz, who's a writer, consultant, and longtime political activist. She's the president of MK Communications, a partner in Democracy Partners, and a founder and co-chair of the newly formed Chicago Women Take Action. She has an article at In These Times, Stopping Trump, the Chicago Model, and her latest article at In These Times is Chicago Activists Should Be Commended, Not Scolded, for Shutting Down Donald Trump's Rally. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.